Big show for you on Tuesday, July 30th, heading into the second round of Democratic debates. We heard from a college professor who has studied these debates in the past, and we talked about what, if any, effect they will have on the whole race. We also spoke with an expert on U.S.-Russia collusion, quote-unquote, over the years, and he says it's nothing new that politicians from both sides have tried to use each other for decades. And we wrapped it up while speaking with former Republican State Senator Len Susio about a new 10-cent per bag fee going into effect at many major Connecticut stores on Thursday, a fee that some stores say they're not going to charge because they're not going to offer plastic carryout bags. And I also had to talk about the reaction I got from a lot of folks regarding my lunch choice.
You're listening to Connecticut Today with Paul Pacelli on WICC 600.
There, it's 3:08, 8 past 3 o'clock. It's hour number 2 here of Connecticut Today. Can I just say something? Oh, by the way, I'll say my name, Paul Pacelli. How are you? Aaron Johnson here with me, other side of the glass. I'm getting pummeled. I'm getting beaten. I am getting pounded, pummeled, and beaten to a pulp on Facebook by my friends, some of my radio fans here. It was a crazy day, so what I did was, I keep here at the station in my car too, because I'm running around like crazy. I keep, you know, some munchy food in, just because I won't be able to eat till I pick up something on the way home tonight. Got here about 11 this morning to do some prep work for the show, and so I said to myself, let me see what kind of reaction this gets. And obviously, you know, my name ends in a vowel. I'm 100% Italian. So I kept it, you know, at my desk. I kept a little, it wasn't even a full-size can. It's like a mini can of Chef Boyardee ravioli. And all right, now, Aaron, you're going to stare at me, too. Here we go. Like the pre-show video wasn't bad enough. So I said, oh, man, I said, I don't want to open it, but I'm really hungry. So I opened it, went to the kitchen here at the station, 45 seconds, and the microwave is fine. I like my food warm, little hot. I don't like it where you're so hungry that you take a bite of it and the insides of your mouth come peeling off, which is a real hazard when you microwave something. Oh, this is fine. This part is nice and warm, and then this part, you know, you bite into it. Anyway, so I took a picture of the... I have to see. So I took a picture of the can of I will admit it, Chef Boyardee ravioli. Now they're trying. Hold on, where's the can? I have it right here. Wait a minute. So the can says, no artificial colors, no artificial flavors, no preservatives. Made with quality ingredients. Tomatoes, tomato paste, water, wheat flour, iron, onion, skim milk, whatever. All right, how bad can it be? It was 7 ounces. So it's not, you know, as I redeposit the can, it's 7 ounces. So I said, well, let me put the picture up on Facebook. And on top of the picture, I put, quote, don't judge me, I'm at work and I'm busy, damn it. Well, you would have thought, honest to God, you would have thought that I just killed Mother Teresa. I know she's dead. I know Mother Teresa is not coming back anytime soon. But she's a saint now. I think the church made her a saint, if I remember. But man, oh man. I'm not going to attribute the names to this. These are all friends and relatives of mine, though. These are not people off the street here. Not good. Another person writes, so this is what conservatives eat? No wonder you're angry all the time. Why, that was a shot. That was a shot. Hey, don't you know that so-and-so deli in our neighborhoods both sell pre-made salads? To which I said, I eat my salad at night. We don't eat salad during the day. That's my father's imprinting.
Remember my rant yesterday about Beyond Meat or whatever it is, the process, the fake meat and sausage made by plant protein? Well, a buddy of mine said, he says this, quote, "Hey, wait a second. I had to hear a whole diatribe around Beyond Beef and the Impossible Burger yesterday, and now you're eating this?" He's got a point. My cousin in Florida writes, "What the hell? Your mom and auntie would be yelling at you right now. Right now." My ex writes, "I can picture Auntie Tina just standing there with her mouth hanging open, wondering what went wrong." Oh, my God. However, a friend of mine who's a former volunteer firefighter and always one of the voices of sanity writes, "I'm amazed but not from you eating canned fake pasta invented by a Frenchman. I'm amazed at all the responses. Come on, people. We've been feeding this crap to kids for generations. It's great emergency food, and its half-life is like a century." Thank you, Ivan. That was my exact notion here. "We used to keep a case of it." Now, you would know this, Aaron, your dad having been a firefighter, right, for years and years. "We used to keep a case of it at the station for rations during extended service. It was pre-cooked. And, hey, if you lost power," here's the line. Ready, folks? "You could heat it with a road flare." Oh, my God. So, yes, I am getting severe stuff here. It's not like I do this every day. I do this like once a month. I have a little 7-ounce can. If you go on our website at WICC600.com, and I'm sorry, on our Facebook page. Go to Facebook at WICC600. Just go to Facebook, put it in the top, no spaces, WICC600. You'll see the pre-show video, and I'll show you exactly. It was 7 ounces of canned, pre-processed, ready to reheat, easy to eat ravioli. And I'm getting absolutely pummeled for this. Pummeled.
Boo this man!
Man, oh man.
Well, as you just heard there from our newscast, bottom of the hour, it is time for night one of round two. 10 Democratic candidates on the stage tonight in Detroit behind 10 different podiums, 10 tomorrow night before they start whittling this field down in another month or two. What about all these debates? And I'm honest to God, do they really make any sort of a difference? Joining us to talk about that right now is an expert. He is recognized as a scholar of presidential debates. Mitchell S. McKinney directs the Political Communication Institute at the University of Missouri. Professor McKinney, Paul here in Bridgeport. How are you today?
I'm good, Paul. Good to be with you.
Do you have your scorecard all set tonight? I mean, it's like going to a ball game. You're tracking 9, 10, 15, 20 people here. It's not like one of those one-on-one or two-on-two here.
No, I do. I actually have a cheat sheet with faces and names to remind me of who some of these folks are.
Boy, I got to tell you, and I guess looking back in history, and we tend to only think, Professor, that history started, 10 minutes ago with Google and Facebook, but we have had an occasional year or two, right, where there have been a load of candidates. I don't think it's been 24, but it has been up there in some years, right?
You're right. This is actually the largest field, 24. I think maybe we're down, it bounced back to 23, or it's somewhere in there. This is the largest field of a party's primary candidate. In terms of debates, we had a Republican debate a couple of cycles ago that had 11. Actually, it was the last cycle that had 11 candidates on the stage at one time. That was the record in terms of 11. We've had 10 before. The next two nights will get us close to the most crowded debate stage, and sometimes that can create a a difficult event with that many people wanting to be heard.
And it comes down, besides refereeing this whole thing and the moderator's role in this, Professor, it also comes down to just getting time on stage, especially if you're an underdog, you're not a politico, for essentially like Mr. Yang or Ms. Williamson.
Yes, and you know, the way that, and this has happened now and for several cycles, that the candidates, when we have these multi-candidate debate stage, candidates will be arranged on the stage according to their poll standing. So you have those leading or front runners there in the center, and then their flank. Eventually we get out to the wings of the maybe contenders. Sometimes I say the also-rans, because we don't hear much from them. We hear them oftentimes sort of pleading, begging for attention, inserting themselves. And I think tonight's debate, tonight and tomorrow night, will be particularly important for this large cast of also-rans. It may be their make or break, or their last stand, if you will. The DNC rules tighten up after this round two. By the time we get to late September, I think I was tracking it, we are now at about 7 or 8 of the current candidates actually meet the criteria for the September debate. Mm-hmm. Now, there may be a few more whose poll standing will increase, whose fundraising numbers will take an uptick. And if that happens, it may be because they're able to have sort of a breakthrough moment. We've seen candidates use their opportunity or take advantage of an opportunity to move the needle in terms of their poll numbers. We've also tracked the giving to these candidates. It parallels when they can get attention on the debate stage, then there will be an uptick there. So for several of these folks, if they're not on the debate stage in round three, then I think the question is, why are they in the race?
Professor, back in the 40s and 50s and 60s and 70s, where we had debates, but we didn't have them to this scale. You know, you look back at the Kennedy-Nixon debate, or you look back at the debate where Gerald Ford made his famous faux pas about whether or not the people of Poland were under Soviet domination. He tried some damage control after that. It didn't work. Would you say back then or not that the debates may have had more of an influence, or do they have more today, do you think?
Well, I think today you're competing with so these candidates are competing with so much media, social media, and entertainment media. You were right. We started televised presidential debates with our presidential candidates in 1960 with Kennedy and Nixon. We had a few radio debates in the 40s and 50s before we got to the 60s. This proliferation of say primary debates, particularly actually the uptick in primary debates. We had a few primary debates in the late 70s, early 80s. When the cable news networks hit middle to late 80s into the 90s particularly, we saw a dramatic uptick in these presidential primary debates, where we've gone through cycles with one party or the other having as many as upper teens, 17, 18, 21, 22 different debates. So in terms of their impact, perhaps it has diminished somewhat. But still, I think I saw the numbers in round one. The debate reached the MSNBC debate in round one was about 18 to 20 million viewers. Now, for all of these candidates, really, that audience is tremendous.
Yeah.
Certainly, that is not the size of an audience that's tuning in to their stump speeches that might be on C-SPAN or might be covered by one of the cable networks. These debates are still seen as an important moment for them to try to connect with voters. For many of these candidates who've not had national exposure or national office, elective office, this is prime time for them to try to have some attention. But then when you divide it 10 times 10, that's where you get, you know, these candidates, some of them only having 1 and 2 minutes throughout the 2-hour debate to be heard. So the impact may be diminished somewhat, but it's still considered, I think, a very important moment for these candidates.
And, Professor, you know, you look at certain debates and certain candidates, and I'm wondering if people who are undecided are looking at a candidate, they seem to me to be looking for secondary cues and secondary characteristics. I mean, look at the spike that Kamala Harris had after she went after Joe Biden on busing, for God's sake. I mean, we haven't discussed busing in this country in 40 years. Now, she took a calculated risk there, and she got, whether or not she was correct on the substance, where she, of course, had to backtrack a little on and do a little damage control, she did get, right, Professor, the buzz that she needed, which of course spiked her numbers for a little while and helped her fundraising.
Right. And as I said earlier, particularly when you've got so many candidates on the stage at one time, although I was surprised in that first debate, the extent to which the discussion was an issue-oriented discussion, as opposed to I was anxious to see 4 years ago on the Republican side with a large field of candidates, those debates at times really devolved into some name-calling, personal attacks. Now, much of that was driven by then-candidate Trump.
Yeah.
But still, it is difficult in 1 minute. It is difficult in 30 seconds to really lay out one's detailed policy proposals. And so you're right about those secondary cues. What voters really come away from, for example, you mentioned Kamala Harris. What we were hearing from viewers of the debate is that she's a fighter. She's aggressively, in that case, taking it to Joe Biden, but extrapolating she would be a fighter in taking it to the other party and taking it to Donald Trump, for example, or, you know, some of the other candidates. They care about the working person. Or now, again, that impression was framed in some discussion of some issue, but it was difficult to really get into the details of the issue. It was really, as you say, those secondary cues that the candidate was giving in terms of the kind of person that they are.
And we always listen, Doctor, as you said, Professor, as you said, the mark that you and I talk about, obviously, to your students, and I talk about on our shows here all the time in Connecticut, the mark left by that Kennedy-Nixon debate, as you well know, was not so much a substantive mark, because a lot of people thought that, you know, Mr. Nixon actually outpointed Kennedy on several, you know, foreign policy issues of that debate. But again, the look, the cool, calm, collected look, the secondary cues of Senator Kennedy at the time versus, you know, Richard Nixon, who certainly had the resume to just waltz into the White House.
Right. And you know, as we're talking about the impact of these debates, and again, this is a primary debate, the central audience for this debate are Democratic voters and those who are trying to make up their mind. Certainly on many of these issues, and we see this in terms of the health care policy and some other policies, where candidates are having really a hard time distinguishing themselves from each other. And certainly across the board on so many policies, most, if not all, of these candidates are going to be very similar, pretty much in the same spot, with some nuance. Mm-hmm. Therefore, when that's the case, what we do rely on is, okay, now I want to understand what type of person is this. Sometimes that comes from their demeanor on the debate stage, how they handle themselves. It may come from their bio, their personal history, the struggles that they've had. That's the kind of narrative that I think that a smart candidate can really weave into their responses when they have their few minutes. To try to connect with voters. So, again, those secondary cues, the voter feels like, hey, you know, I feel like I know more about this person. I feel like I want to know more about this person. I hope they will stay in. I want to give them additional chance to make an impression on me.
You know, Professor, we talked about a few seconds ago, people looking for how somebody is aggressive, if they can take the fight to someone. Let's look at the flip side of that, right? We already hear that Joe Biden has promised to be more aggressive. And boy, I tell you, Professor, he kind of had a deer in the headlights look in that first debate when Kamala Harris came after him.
You know, I agree. I actually, as we were just a few minutes into the debate, I thought, you know, Joe Biden, he looked surprised that he was getting the attacks that he was in for, somewhat even befuddled. There were moments in that debate where it was clear that he wanted to get out of it. He was taking his time giving back. You know, I said, well, at least it wasn't a George H.W. Bush moment in the 1992 town hall debate where he was checking his watch.
Yeah, remember that? Oh, my God. Remember that? Jeez. But the vice president, he certainly, I mean, when Kamala Harris was laying into him and he just kind of stared blankly at the camera versus even having, not even having the wherewithal, or I guess he was so shocked to even look at her. And a lot of times, Professor, it doesn't take a verbal response. Sometimes you can just shake your head and just say, nope, and or even smile back at someone, right, and say, come on, what are you doing with this?
Yeah. You know, I thought his answers early in the that debate, and then his sort of nonverbal responses when he was being attacked. It appeared that as he had been doing on the stump, sort of trying to pull off a general election strategy, that you know the message, or at least his approach, was that it's his nomination, that he's now taking on Donald Trump. And then, you know, it was just a few minutes into that debate that he started to understand that his fellow Democratic candidates were not, they're not hearing of that. They're not going to allow that, that he's going to have to fight for this nomination. It's not automatically his. And I do think we'll see a different Joe Biden actually tomorrow night. We'll need to see a different Joe Biden, or there then I think would be further questions of really, you know, is it his nomination? That will happen. And then, of course, tonight, you know, we've got Sanders and Warren sort of center stage, and will they... they tend to attract some of the same voters. Will they go after each other, or will they play nice? That's, you know, to be we'll have to see what happens there. And then a number of those other candidates, perhaps that are emerging or trying to emerge, will they have sort of a Kamala Harris breakout moment? Whether that's O'Rourke or Klobuchar. You know, Pete Buttigieg is there in terms of trying to establish himself. So we'll see what happens with those. And then, you know, we have on the flanks of the stage those two or three on both sides that sometimes we have to remind ourselves who they are. if they are not able to sort of capitalize on a moment or two to have us to want to take a second chance, then this will be, I think, the last time we'll see some of those folks.
Yeah, and you know what? And you wonder if we'll get a moment, Professor, regarding, for example, what I would just love to see in one of these debates, like you say, is somebody take a chance but not be so... what's the word I'm looking for? Comedic about it, but really say something passionate. Like, for example, you remember when Kamala Harris came out a few months ago and said, well, you know, yeah, I would consider getting away, doing away, rather, with private health insurance, which about 90% of the country has. Most people like their coverage. And although he's not in the debates, Howard Schultz, you know, the guy who runs Starbucks or used to, he came out the next day and said, well, that's just stupid. I think he actually used that phrase, too. It's rare that you see, Professor, anybody, even if they're trying to make a mark for themselves, it's rare you see them step out of the party orthodoxy in one of these debates to look at somebody and say, you know what, with all due respect, that's just a bad idea. Where are you coming from on that? I think something like that would catapult them even further.
Yes, and you know, our work has shown that voters, particularly when they're tuning into debate, they can detect those sort of moments of authenticity when one is as we say being real, and this debate moment is seen as one of the least scripted moments. The candidates are not there with teleprompters. They're not. It's not their slick ads or their stump speeches, which they control. And so when we have those moments, voters tend to respond. But then, you know, as you said, the ability of a candidate to call out, say, their opponent to try to make a distinction, to point out when something, when an idea perhaps is not a very good idea. You know, one thing we saw 4 years ago on the Republican side in those primary debates was very different than we normally see. We typically don't see primary debates because these are candidates all of the same party. Very conflictual or the most attack-oriented in terms of how the candidates will call one another out. Now, 4 years ago on the Republican side, that, again, the typical rules, the playbook was thrown out the window where Donald Trump really took on those other Republicans, sometimes in a rather personal, you know, some said mean, vicious way. I don't anticipate that we'll see, you know, some even question whether Kamala Harris's attacks or taking on Joe Biden went too far. I don't anticipate that we'll see a strategy by any of these Democrats as the way to garner their attention to get buzz around them would be to take the playbook from 4 years ago on the Republican side. But again, for many of these, this is a last stand, so they're going to have to find some way to garner some attention.
We'll see what happens. Professor, thank you so much. Professor Mitchell S. McKinney, he directs the Political Communications Institute at the University of Missouri, and yes, he will have his scorecard ready tonight. Professor, thank you. Good stuff. We appreciate it.
Paul, thank you very much.
Thanks. Appreciate it. Yeah, get that scorecard out, kids. 10 people on the stage.
Yeah.
Well, we've been hearing over and over and over again since Mr. Trump was elected about Russian collusion, Russian interference in the American electoral process. Being kind of a student of history, I sit back and I laugh because this has been going on really for decades early on here. And joining us right now is a gentleman to talk about this. I love this sort of stuff. We welcome Professor Harvey Clear, at the Andrew W. Mellon Professor Emeritus of Politics and History at Emory University. Professor Clear, Paul here in Bridgeport. How are you, sir?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm very, very good. Thank you. And I was excited that I got a pitch for you, sir, to have you on because, you know, everyone thinks time began with the 2015 election year. And look, we all know the Russians are not Boy Scouts. We know this. We understand this. We've known this for hundreds of years. However, I think something that you wanted to bring to the table today is that American politicians, frankly, Professor, on both sides of the aisle have tried to advance their causes using the Russians when they can.
That's absolutely true. It's happened for many, many decades. The particular person that I focused on in a new book that I just published last week, the book's called The Millionaire Was a Soviet Mole, The Twisted Life of David Carr. David Carr was a really fascinating character who lived many different lives, newspaper man, public relations guru, businessman, deal maker. And in the 1970s in particular, he began making deals in Russia, originally with Armand Hammer, and then he set up shop for himself. And we don't know the exact date, but it's sometime in the early 1970s, he was recruited by the KGB. There's a KGB memo that came out after the collapse of the Soviet Union that called him a competent KGB source. And the interesting thing about Carr is that he was very well connected in American political life. And in the 1970s, he was very close to several Democrats who were running for president of the United States. He traveled with Sergeant Shriver, for example, and was on his campaign staff. He was very close to Scoop Jackson, who ran for president in 1976. After Jackson faded away, he gave his support to Jerry Brown, governor of California. And all the time, he was reporting to the Russians about what was going on in those campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very close to Ted Kennedy as well.
You know, Professor, to me, when you look back at a great moment in history here, or history, a moment in history that's often taught, I mean, you can only, this was right out in front when we look at perhaps the Yalta Conference when, you know, you had a very frail FDR there with Churchill and Joe Stalin right there, post-World War II, a murderous butcher. And then years after that, you even had Harry Truman, who was in a scenario radio where he would say, oh, that's just Uncle Joe. We deal with Uncle Joe. So even back decades ago, Professor Clare, this to me was somewhat out in the open.
Well, it certainly was. And, you know, Alger Hiss, who we now know, of course, was a Soviet spy, was at Yalta. But it was not just Hiss. In the 1930s and 1940s, a number of Soviet agents were in high-ranking positions in the American government. Harry Dexter White was the Undersecretary of the Treasury. He was a Soviet spy. Lachlan Curry was one of six White House aides to Franklin Roosevelt. He was a Soviet spy. Duncan Lee, who was the chief legal advisor to General William Donovan of OSS, was a Soviet spy. And there were hundreds more. We now know that there were approximately 500 Americans who served as sources for the Soviet Union in the 1930s and 1940s. And remember that, particularly in the 1940s, during World War II, and many of these people were doing this, we were allies with the Soviet Union.
Professor, what is your reaction to when people say, well, the Russians helped Donald Trump get elected, and without their help, he would not have won? What would you say to that person?
Well, I think that's an exaggeration. There's no doubt that the Russians interfered in the electoral process, some of their actions, perhaps most of them, many of them, served to undermine Hillary Clinton. But I think that not quite so much trying to elect Donald Trump is to cause chaos and distrust in the American political system. That was their motive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that to a significant extent, they succeeded.
But isn't that, Professor, look, I'm no great authority here, but I sit back and I do shows like this, and I read a lot, and I study a lot, and I sit back in my chair and I go, okay, that's what the Russians do. That's who Vladimir Putin is. He's a former KGB guy, much the way George H.W. Bush was a former CIA guy. I don't approve of what he's doing, but I sit there and read it and say, okay, who in the modern world, Professor, is not aware of this? It's what they do.
Well, you're absolutely correct. And Putin was shaped by his experience in the KGB. I would describe him as a KGB thug. When you say who's not aware of it, well, remember back when Mitt Romney ran for president, and during one of the debates,
oh yeah,
with Barack Obama, Romney said that, you know, Russia was our most significant enemy and foe. And the reaction not only of Obama but of the media was hilarity. Romney was stuck in some old Cold War paradigm. Well, he was absolutely correct.
He was 100% right. He was 100% right, Professor.
Yep, he was. And the Russians used to call the United States the main enemy in their internal KGB communications. They referred to the U.S. as the main enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's changed at all.
What do you think their goal would be again in this upcoming election cycle? Now, President Trump, obviously, unless he's removed in the next year or so, I mean, he is going to be an incumbent, and they're looking to probably shaking out who they think is going to come out of the Democratic field. Do you think they will do the same thing again?
Well, their tactics may be different, but I think that they will continue to try to foment uncertainty and chaos in the American political system. Don't forget that again, several years before, President Obama, after a meeting with Medvedev, who at the time was the prime minister of Russia, was caught on an open mic saying, tell Vladimir that after the election I'll have more freedom to maneuver. The Russians, I don't think, are acting on the basis of any kind of ideology. They're perfectly willing to cooperate with Democrats, with Republicans. Makes no never mind to them. And, one of the things I talk about in the book is that, again, KGB documents that leaked after the collapse of the Soviet Union show that Ted Kennedy, who was sort of connected to the Russians by David Carr, who was a friend of his.
Yeah.
Kennedy was telling the Russians secretly that he wanted to work with them to undermine Ronald Reagan.
I mean, the stuff he would, you know, Professor, that was going to be my next question. I'm glad you brought it up. We had Ted Kennedy here, still, right, revered to being the lion of the Senate, the great negotiator. But as you point out in this book, and I've tried to at least have people read over the years, this guy, for whatever else you think of him, was directly not trying to undermine the President of the United States.
He was. And by the way, he not only was trying to undermine the Republican president of the United States, he also, a couple years before that, tried to undermine Jimmy Carter, who was a fellow Democrat. he communicated, again, secretly with the Soviet Union, talking about the fact that he was very upset by Carter's harsh actions towards the Soviet Union after the invasion of Afghanistan. And he wanted to work with the Russians to undermine Jimmy Carter. So he was perfectly willing to undermine both a Democratic president, and of course he was running for president against Carter at the time. He was perfectly willing to undermine a Democratic president and a Republican president for his own interests.
I mean, can you imagine, Professor, and the guest is Professor Harvey Clare of Emory University. Can you imagine? I mean, let's say that Mr. Trump is defeated a year from November and there is a Democratic president. Can you imagine the hue and cry, as well it should be, if a Republican, if Mitch McConnell started a back-channel discussion with Vladimir Putin, hey, let's undermine Kamala Harris or let's undermine Joe Biden. I mean, that would be a story next to Watergate.
It would be. It would be. You know, it's quite remarkable that in the past, I would say the past 30 years or so, American politicians have been much more willing to politic in secret and negotiate in secret with foreign countries. It used to be that that was regarded as a real no-no, but I'm afraid not anymore.
So, Professor, I want to follow up on the question I gave you before we took the break there. Thanks for being with us. You know, you highlight so many different things that you and I know because we read about this stuff where we're addicts of history. Is any of this stuff taught to the level it needs to be today so the young voters can put all this in perspective?
I would say no. It's quite depressing, actually, how little even students at very, very good colleges and universities know about history. They're woefully ignorant. The textbooks that are often used in high school don't include information about the kinds of things I've been talking about. For example, you can read textbooks in American history that still suggest that the question of whether Alger Hiss or the Rosenbergs were Soviet spies is an open question, which is utter nonsense. I mean, these things have been documented over and over again with material that's come out of archives since the end of the Cold War.
And obviously, Professor, I would think that the problem there you have is maybe, and you know, we don't like to point fingers here, but heck, you and I will. I mean, there are many leftist intellectuals that still dominate secondary education, and particularly, Professor, correct, the level that you've been fortunate to teach at.
Unfortunately, yes. You know, I would say that the imbalance, the ideological imbalance, certainly in higher education, is extraordinary. And the way that communism is taught, you know, and now you have students that have had no experience or understanding of what communist societies were like, and they're whitewashed, and there's a relentless attack on the principles of free enterprise and capitalism and democracy. The argument is that democracy is a sham, which, of course, you know, is the Soviet position for many, many, many decades. And, you know, is in a way, that's one of the motives that Russia, current-day Russia, has for what it's doing in elections, to try to demonstrate that democracy is a sham.
So what would you say then, Professor, in closing here? Let's say you were engaged in a conversation, say with a younger person or maybe, you know, just a person who wasn't as astute on this stuff as you are. And they said, you know, Professor, I'm just, I don't know what to do in 2020. And I'm, you know, I'm afraid President Trump is a tool of the Russians. I can't believe this is happening. I don't know what's real. I don't know how to digest all this stuff. What would you advise to that person?
Well, you have to learn history, and one of the best ways to do so is to go back to original sources and to read people that use original sources. And, you know, unfortunately, lots of current students and many teachers have had their understanding of America and the Cold War and so on shaped by Howard Zinn, the late author who wrote People's History of the United States, which is a fantasy book, and it's very, very widely used in American high schools and colleges. Now, there's a brand new history of the United States by a friend of mine, actually, named Wilfred McClay, and just came out in the last few months, published by Encounter Books, and it's a real corrective to this jaundiced view of American life and American democracy. America has flaws, absolutely, but compared to the flaws and crimes of many other regimes, the United States looks awfully, awfully good.
Certainly does. The name of the book, The Millionaire Was a Soviet Mole, The Twisted Life of David Carr, and also providing a little bit of perspective here as to what the Russians have done and what some American politicians have done to undermine our own political system over the years, has been Professor Harvey Clear. He is the Andrew Mellon Professor Emeritus of Politics and History, former chair of the Poli-Sci Department at Emory University. Professor, thank you. I have now ascribed your book into my Amazon wish list, and I will dive into it. Professor, thank you. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks. Bye-bye. That's it, folks. A lot of people don't know that about Ted Kennedy. A lot of people didn't know. He actively tried to undermine Ronald Reagan by doing a back-channel thing with the Russians. Now, you could say, well, that's the same thing Trump did. No, it wasn't. No, it's not. It's not. It's just not. It's not. Len Susio's with us. So, Len, we're supposed to get $55 million in revenue from bags that might not even be offered anymore. How does that work?
Yeah, that's interesting. I was at my local Stop and Shop this weekend, you know, getting a small local purchase, and I was using the plastic bags, and the assistant manager was there, and I said, well, I guess things are going to change in the next few days. And he said, oh, yeah. He said, we're not even going to offer plastic bags on Thursday, August 1st. We're going to just go straight to paper bags. And I said, well, wait a minute, you're the largest grocery store chain in the state. And the governor was counting on getting $54.5 million from this tax on plastic bags, which is effective on the 1st of August, this Thursday. Mm-hmm. And what's going to happen? He said, well, they're not going to get a nickel from us. They're going straight to paper bags. And I now learned that some of the other major chains in the state, Big Y, et cetera, are going the same way.
Yeah.
So I think there's almost $55 million in the budget to balance the budget that is not going to be there. I think only a tiny fraction of it. So we're looking at another gaping hole in the budget that's going to be brought about by the fact that Connecticut grocery stores are not going to basically be using plastic bags two more days from now.
You know, Len, you've spent some time in the General Assembly, and I know that they use, you know, the nonpartisan office there to come up with these numbers. But in this sort of a sense, Len, when these numbers are estimated by the legislative office up there, the nonpartisan budget office or whatever the name of the office is,
right.
Does anybody ever raise their hand? Remember our teachers in grammar school, Len? Raise your hand if you have a question. Does anybody ever raise their hand and say, well, wait a minute, supposing we don't get $55 million. Does anybody ever ask that, Len?
Well, the Office of Fiscal Analysis is the nonpartisan arm of the legislature. They're supposed to do that. But, of course, in this case, number one, there's no experience with it whatsoever. Number two, it was being put into effect pretty quickly. So I think most people thought, well, hey, the stores will go along with this for another year or two, and then, yeah, we'll see what happens. But no one anticipated, I think, that you're probably going to see a 99% dropout. and the fact that there's this loophole that they can provide paper bags for 10 cents and not a nickel if it goes to the government, the stores can keep the 10 cents. Stop and Shop, actually, I was in it today. Again, they're already using the paper bags. They're not even using the plastic bags anymore. So no one thought of that. No one realized that, hey, a business person is going to sit down and think, wait a minute, I've got a choice here. I can use plastic bags and charge my customers 10 cents per bag, and I have to remit every nickel and dime of that to the government. I've got to be accountable for it. I got to collect it. I got to report on it. I'm subject to audits. Or I can switch to paper bags, and I can charge them 10 cents a bag for that, and I can keep every nickel and dime of it and not have to report to the government. No one thought about that logical response because no one in the government thinks logically.
Now, and two other things I noticed, Len, in reading about this, and the guest is Len Susio, we're talking about this new plastic bag ban or tax or however you want to term it that goes into effect this week. Number one, Len, I see that there's kind of a soft target of 2021 to ban plastic bags altogether if the money is coming in or not. And number two, I guess the stores can still give out plastic bags if they're what? And this gets technical. It's 4 mils or less. In other words, they can still give out really thin ones. Am I reading that right?
No, it actually goes the other way. But the plastic bags, for example, if you're in the store, grocery store, in the delicatessen, and they give you a bag for your sandwich, that doesn't get counted. It's strictly the bags at the checkout counter, the typical bags you see when you go to Stop and Shop or Big Y or one of these other grocery store chains. Those are the bags that are subject to it. Even plastic bags that are that you get your dry cleaning in are not subject to it. It's 99% aimed at the grocery stores and use of these plastic bags. The store, the assistant store manager at the Stop and Shop I went to, he said, "You know how many of these we go through a month?" I said, "No, one store." Would you want to guess how much you're talking about?
Oh, now you're talking about, all right, tell you, Len, hang on. I'm going to think about that through the break. Hang on. So you're asking us to guess how many of the standard carry-out bags that you leave the checkout with, how many in one Stop and Shop store? That was your question.
That's right.
All right, hang on, Len. We'll think about that. Okay, Len, so you spoke with the store manager at the Meriden Stop and Shop, and he said to you, how many carry-out bags does he go through in a month?
Yes.
I'm going to, well, my producer, Aaron, guessed a 500,000. I'm going to go higher. I'm going to say 700,000. What did he say?
His count was 200,000 a month in one store, though.
Oh, and one store.
Six stores in Connecticut. Now, here's another good question for you, Paul. If the state expected to collect $55 million in the next 2 years at 10 cents a bag, how many bags does that represent?
Oh, boy, wait a minute. I can even do this. That represents, 55. Oh, wait a minute. Now, Len, you're making me move the decimal point. I know you're a banker by trade, but hang out with me here. Hold on. 55 million. So that'll be 5.5. So that'll be 550,000?
550 million.
550 million. Oh, that's right, because I'm going the other way. Yes.
Yeah, that's right. You went the other way.
I went the other way with the decimal point. See that?
Yeah.
Gosh, Len. Jeez.
Yeah.
See, now you know why you were the guy that used to do paperwork on mortgage and I wasn't, right? So that's right. So if it's 10 cents a piece, oh, my God.
Yeah. And Paul, now I know why you're the veteran broadcaster. You know how to keep your audience through an ad.
Wait, yo, about that, huh?
Everybody's waiting with bated breath now. What are we talking about here?
So oh my Lord, jeez, that's right. Because you would have to do 10 times 10.
Yeah.
So the bottom line is, Len, that what we're driving at here is again. This is, the shell game of anticipated income that we don't have.
Yeah, it was just made up. No one really knew what to expect. But I'm surprised that nobody has questioned the governor or the folks up in Hartford. Well, wait a minute now. It looks like there's going to be a $55 million gaping hole in your budget based on, what the grocery store chains are saying they're going to do. How are you going to make up for that $55 million all of a sudden? I want to hear the answer to that question. Maybe you think, Paul, they might raid the special transportation fund again?
Yeah, right. Hey, the heck would fill in potholes, Len? Oh my God! Well,
yeah.
Listen, do us all a favor and keep the good fight up on this. Let us know what you think. If you hear anything scuttlebutt wise, give us a call, okay?
You will be the first one, Paul.
Thanks, Len. Appreciate it. There you go. There's my guy in Hartford there, former Republican State Senator Len Susio.